Hello, everyone. You're listening to Pixel Pixel, where the X is silent, but our love for women in horror most definitely isn't. This is episode 124. I am one of your hosts, as always, Anne. And with me, also as always, is your other host, Marcus.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Good. I thought you were going to say not so great because you've had a bit of a rough day.
That's why I'm fine.
Oh, just fine. Mm-hmm. Not good. Yeah. Okay. But you're doing better.
Mm-hmm.
Good. We actually don't have a lot of life news, so I'm like grasping at straws to, to do like our transition here. But, you know, sometimes that's the way it is. We have more news this time around and also lots of media to talk about. So we'll just hustle along.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, in life news, we went to a really cool place that I wanted to briefly talk about because I think it's such a cool concept. We went, I think it was the weekend before last, to this, basically a person converted their garage into what they're calling the OC Creative Reuse Center, OC standing for Orange County. And I guess creative reuse centers are a thing that like people do around the United States and maybe other countries as well, I'm not sure. It's basically a thrift store, but for creative supplies, so art and craft-related supplies. You could get fabric and ribbon and buttons and papers, stamps, almost anything you could think of that you could use in crafting, they have. But it's just like a regular thrift store, but specialized to creative items, so you can donate to them and also buy things from them. So they are, as I said, operating out of this person's garage. They want to get a store eventually, but I think they just started up last year, and they're basically raising money through getting donations and selling items to move into a real space at some point. So we went and checked it out, and even just being out of their garage, it was really nice. There was so much cool stuff. And I think we oohed and aahed for like nearly an hour. It felt mm-hmm. like we were there quite a while and found some cool goodies, including some stuff you've got on your table over there, which yeah. I guess wouldn't really normally be something I would expect to find at this place. But what was it?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty random. There was a box called Comics and they had various old manga. And then they also had a couple old anime magazines. So we got one from each. One was called Animag, and one is called Anime Zine. So these are like step up from when people were making anime and sci-fi zines, more produced and published magazine, true magazines. But still before, like, kind of the first anime real magazines came out, like the more widespread ones anyway.
Yeah, so it's pretty DIY looking. I actually mm-hmm. wasn't that familiar with these, but it looks like they were published in the late 80s mm-hmm. and very mecha focused, which I guess makes sense, but very cool to look at. And yeah, randomly just like a whole stack of these they had, and we decided to just get a couple since you don't really need a million of them, but they're very cool to flip through.
Yeah, I just wanted to look at them. I think it's fun.
Yeah, they also had a couple VHS. I got like Sakura Wars and some other anime movie I've never heard of for a dollar each. As for actual supplies, I got some cool like paper punches, some fabric, and ribbon, and yeah, basically it was hard not to like go crazy and want to buy everything. Even had like spools of fabric that you could cut yourself, and just really loved it. So definitely excited for them. Hope they're doing well to raise money toward their goal, because I definitely want to keep going there and buying things, and maybe I'll donate some stuff sometime. It's a nice in thing to do. And yeah, if you ever want to check one out, you could search for a creative reuse center in your area or just like a craft thrift store. They have those too. As for other life stuff, I published an article with Yadatachi, and it is about our trip to the Summer Hikaru Died exhibition. That was the anime exhibition held in Tokyo last year, and I thought Yadatachi might like to share that with their readers. So I did a report for them on that. And if you want to read about that, you can check out the link in the show notes. There aren't really any spoilers, I don't believe, if you haven't seen the anime or read the manga. And it also doesn't really take away from it if you haven't read or watched it. Again, I think I mentioned, did I mention on the
show? You did, yes.
Yeah, we talked about it a while ago in the podcast. And I think I said then that we weren't super familiar with it when we went even. So it can be appreciated either way. So if you're interested in seeing that with photos and everything, you can check that out. And yeah, moving on to news, the hot new game has a demo. You're excited to play it?
Yes, well, for now. The game we're talking about is Tomodachi Life Living the Dream. A demo just dropped as of the time of recording this. And it's something that will hopefully get people excited about the full game when it comes out. In, what was it, April 16th. Of note, if you do play the game, your save data will transfer over to the full game. It only lets you make 3 characters, though. So one of the big appeals of Tomodachi Life, or maybe that'll only let you save 3 characters, I don't know. But, I mean, the appeal of the game is making tons of characters.
Million characters, yeah.
So obviously they're kind of restricting that for the demo. I think that I want to get the demo just to dip my toe back in to Tomodachi Life and see, do I really like this game enough to want to get it for real? Or is it just like a little thing that I'm like, oh, isn't that fun? That was fun. And then I'm going to play it and be like, yeah, this isn't really that fun.
Uh-huh.
Because you don't really do that much.
No.
As much as create the characters and watch them.
You played which one a bit?
The
3DS?
One on... Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, wasn't that the only one released in English?
Was it?
I think so.
No. Was it?
I thought so.
Okay. See what I know. Okay. Well, either way, when you played that, did you find that that was the case?
It was fun for a while.
Well, you could always go back to that one.
I guess so.
It looks good. And I'm curious to see how it manages the demo. Like, it's gotta like cut you off somewhere, but it's not really the kind of game where it's like you play a chapter and then you're done, you know. And if it transfers over to the full game, is it just a stopping point? It just says thanks for playing, and like, you know, is it a timer? Like, I'm just interested.
Yeah, I didn't see a report on how it ends.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do get to whatever the end of the demo is, you will get a free costume.
Ooh.
That you can bring into the game, so there is an end.
Okay.
I'm just not clear right now what it is.
Yeah, what you do to, okay, get there. Well, we'll download it and check it out. That's for Switch 1, but you can obviously download it on the Switch 2 as well.
Yep.
As for Switch 2 related news, just today, as of this recording, Nintendo of America put out an update about physical and digital game pricing. So they're saying that there will be a difference, a difference in the price between physical and digital first-party games. So games published by Nintendo that are Nintendo Switch 2 exclusives. So very specific there. But this will be starting with that new Yoshi game, of which I can't remember the name. Yoshi and the Mysterious Book, which we have to play that. I want to play that one.
Okay, sure.
It's going to be starting with that, and so people looked into it to see exactly what this price difference was, and it looks like the pre-orders for the digital version are $10 cheaper for the Yoshi game, specifically.
I'm a little surprised that it is something that they're stating now, and it wasn't always necessarily that way, but it's fine. I think it's nice to have the digital cheaper, because a lot of people kind of feel like digital should be cheaper. I think that regardless, if a game has a physical option and it's Nintendo first party, ideally I would like to get it physically. I just like collecting things. And $10 is not like enough of a difference for me to be like, well, it's so cheap, I'll get it this way. But obviously a lot of people will think otherwise. You know, these games are not cheap, so $10 is $10. It's something. And then you got to worry about buying SD cards, micro SD cards instead.
Yeah, right.
To store them. But otherwise, I think it's fine. I think it's smart that they just specify it's only our games. We cannot control, you know, all the other publishers in the world and what they're going to charge and whether they're going to offer discounts or not, because all of them are going to come to their own decisions, as they already have shown. So it's still going to be a kind of a weird marketplace on the Switch 2 with all these varying prices, but you know, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, it really does feel like one of those things, like, why weren't digital games always cheaper? But here we are, I guess better late than never anyway. But yeah, I agree. Also, I feel like we don't buy that many games, like Nintendo first party games. We buy one here and there, right?
We buy kind of like the ones that we deem as big. We have Mario Kart. We have Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
We will get Yoshi.
Uh-huh.
But not everything, like not Metroid Prime, for example.
I guess Tomodachi Life is first party. It is, so yes. Maybe we get a few. I was going to say, well, we don't pick up every single new release, so it doesn't hit as hard. Like, oh, we could have been saving all this money if we went digital.
True, only. Yeah, we're not getting a lot of games.
And I guess this is only for U.S. right now, or at least this notice was for the U.S. market, so I'm not sure what the other countries are going to be doing, if they're going to have the same sort of situation or not.
I don't know. Let's say Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Were the prices the same? Do you know? I don't even know because I don't pay attention.
I believe they were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we shall see.
Yes, we shall see. Okay, and now you've got some drama to share with us. I'm really excited to hear you regale this because you kind of told me about it as it was happening in real time or as you were catching up on it. And it seems like quite the saga, so...
Yeah, so this is about the application called Booklore, which in previous episodes I have mentioned because it is an open source self-hosted ebook platform, which I had recently gotten into and started using. Basically, where you can store your ebooks, you can tag them, you can categorize them. You can sync them with your e-reader or your phone, and the progress will sync between the device and Booklore. It has a built-in e-reader or like a reader app if you want. And also it could sync to apps such as Hardcover to mark your books as read on those websites. So, you know, just kind of a neat little tool that I liked and was using regularly. I mean, at this point I still am, but... You know, I really liked it a lot. So enough so to join their Discord. Because a lot of open source apps have Discords nowadays. So I went to the Discord and for the most part, I didn't really look at it. Except for there were some things that I was following like I wanted. I wanted to get more stats into Booklore. And there was someone working on that. So sometimes I would check in to see like, is it in there yet? I want my stats.
Uh-huh.
But that was like mostly what I did with that Discord, just kind of keeping tabs. And then like at some point I got like one of those everyone notices on Discord, and the developer was like apologizing about something, and they're like, I need to take some time away. I was like, what? I was like, what's this about? And then like I looked on the self-hosted Reddit and saw like things about Booklore, people talking about like what are alternatives to Booklore. I'm like, what is happening? What did I miss? What did I just miss that happened? And it seemed like numerous things, but kind of one of the things that had happened was the developer first asked in a survey on the Discord, like a poll, do you want an iOS app or an Android app first? And more people voted for Android because of course self-hosted freaks are all about Android, myself included. And then the developer was like, well, I'm making an iOS app. And then, I mean, that was your plan, then why even ask? And then the other thing was, or maybe more of an issue, was that the iOS app was like paid or subscription-based. And so that didn't sit well with people. You know, there's nothing wrong with an open source application having a subscription or a one-time fee, you know, if it's good, some people will be willing to pay for it. the thing is, what people didn't like was that it's like, here's this free thing, but now you're kind of paywalling a component of it, and people didn't really like that and started to get mad. And so then, I guess what happened, because I didn't see it live, the developer was like having a fit and said basically that they were going to make the app closed source. And based on, I don't know all the types of Creative Commons and things, but I guess the license that they had applied, in theory, they can't just do that with the application, revoke it and make it closed source. I don't really know the details, but basically people were just like angry at the developer, and the developer did not take it well. You know, fights on the internet can get quite ugly. Again, I did not see anything directly that occurred, but then I was like, okay, whatever, I'll just keep the app for now, because what does it matter? Then I got another everyone notification. This was maybe like a couple days later, the developer apologizing and basically saying Book Lore is dead. And then, so I saw that because I read it. And then like a few minutes later, the whole Discord was gone. And I'm like, okay, so now what? So basically, yes. So the developer ended up killing Book Lore. And since then, other people have banded together to try to kind of do a fork off of that program to continue it and continue developing it. So that's happening. Because even though Book Lore is dead, like, I have it installed, so I can just have that as long as I leave it there. You know, it will just never receive any updates as is. Some things that I found out after the big Discord explosion was that something that the developer was doing is that when you have an open source project on something like GitHub, the project is there, the code is there, and anyone can look at it and propose enhancements or new features or updates or bug fixes with their own code and like an explanation of that, and like basically submit it, like, here is this thing that I made that will help this program. And the person who owns the program, effectively, in this case, the main developer of it, can look at that and determine, no, I don't want to take this suggestion or this code, or yes, and like merge it into their master file, so to speak. So one thing that the developer was apparently doing was receiving all these requests and then denying them, and then using AI to rewrite the code and implement that into the program as if they are some genius who doesn't need help from anyone, which is not the spirit of open source at all. Open source is all about collaboration, not about, I don't know, taking all the glory for it. So that's not a good look at all. unfortunate. And I think that that is probably the bigger sin than anything else that I saw anyway. So I don't know. You know, I was sitting here before the podcast wondering why would people do these types of things? And also, I think they also use a lot of AI in other parts of the application, not just in the rewriting of the pull requests or what have you. And I was like, well, probably a lot of people want to make money, and they're like, oh, I can code up something that people want and then I'll charge for it. So that's probably why. And these people are not in the spirit of open source, are not, like, you know, happy to take feedback.
Well, then why even make it criticism? Open source, though? Why not just originally release it as a paid thing?
If playing out my assumption, these people don't know anything. That's just kind of the standard thing to do. You put your project on GitHub. And probably AI agents expect you to do that too. I don't know. It's like, you go to GitHub or Codeberg or other things. I'm guessing that's why, because yes, you don't have to. You don't have to be public at all. You can just have this private thing. In this case, though, maybe it's like they wanted the people to give feedback so they could know what to do. Because if you really aren't a developer, you don't know anything. You don't know, like, any, you know, like, what to ask for, how to ask for it, what kinds of things you need. So I don't know. But it was a very weird, very sudden saga. And I still have book lore. It's still chugging away as is with the bugs that exist in it still there. But it's fine. At some point, I'll probably try out another tool. There are many other types of things like it, just different. So I'll try one at some point. It's just like really weird. I haven't seen this before in my time in the open source community and the self-hosted community. But I have a feeling it'll become more common as more people use AI to try to code up apps. One thing that really should have stuck out to me, and it just didn't hit me at the time because I've never seen it before, was like, there were many problems with the application and it's like they were never fixed. It's just like, here's a new feature, here's a new feature, here's a new feature. Unrelated features, just like new features. Mm. So it's like, okay, maybe that's something I should look out for in the future when they fail to address the existing issues that people bring up and instead just keep putting out new things without addressing them. Maybe that's a sign of AI coding, because if you don't know how to code, then you don't know necessarily how to resolve the problems or how to ask the AI to resolve them. But add a shiny new feature, sure, it can do that. It can bolt something else on nice that will break something else that you won't know happens. So maybe that's part of it. But anyway, I'll find something in the future. But for now, this is working.
It's a bummer, but kind of funny to hear about.
It's just so dramatic. Crazy.
I feel like I've heard of stuff like that, like people throwing a tantrum and then closing everything down or being like, I'm not doing this anymore. But you say you've never experienced that in the open source community.
Not personally, no, but I have a feeling it will just become more common.
Yeah.
Which is a shame.
Yes. And it's a bummer to find out that it was coded by AI.
Probably not entirely, but that's definitely in there somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, well. Actually, this whole discussion and then your sort of eureka moment reminded me that I recently read a blog post by a fan translator that we talked about Jingle Cats a while back on the podcast. They were the fan translator for Jingle Cats, among other things. And they wrote a blog post responding to the Segagaga fan translation. And that's something I think you were more aware of than me, because it wasn't really on my radar. But you can correct me if I'm wrong. But my understanding is that this is a cult classic game, with a cult fan favorite game that people have wanted to get localized or fan translated for a long time. Has a lot of very like niche like Sega references. Yes. And I guess some group or someone announced that they were going to translate it. The translation came out and it was only after the fact, after it had gotten fairly wide recognition and coverage. And this person actually endorsed it, I believe, or they shared it. And so that's part of the reason why they wrote this article as well, is because everybody was all excited. They shared the news and it turned out that it used AI in the translation. Mm-hmm. And then people were really bummed out. And is that basically the gist of it from what you know?
Well, I mean, I don't really know anything about it. I didn't look into it.
Okay. I brought it up on the spot. Yeah. Well, that's my understanding. And somebody can write in the show if you know anything else about it. But it's not so much that I wanted to talk about that, because I think AI is being used in translation, fan, and otherwise a lot now anyway. But something that the translator in their article kind of responding to this was talking about, that they started out in the fan translation community, I can't quite remember when, like 2019, 2020, and they started talking about like their experience within the community. And there were also some comments on the article by people who claimed that they were in like the fan translation community for manga, like scan awaiting and things like that. And there was this prevalent idea that because of AI making things like translating and also coding and like figuring out the process of like actually implementing the translations into the game, that there are a lot of people that are like seeing this, or maybe seeing this as a way to like maybe not get rich quick, because I don't know that you're going to make any money fan translating things, but get, you know, famous attention. Yes. And you may get some money if you like start a Patreon, because some people do that, or like post videos on YouTube about your translation and, you know, add ads to that. So when you mention that about this whole debacle, and that might be a reason why someone would do this for book lore and, you know, code something, I was like, oh yeah. And we're seeing that in the fan translating community too. Yeah, people want to be known as like the person that translates right, and release a fan translation, and, you know, because it does get covered, especially if it's a title that people have really wanted translated for a really long time. Yeah, you know, there's coverage and people get to feel cool for a minute, I guess. But I guess we're only going to see more of that in a lot of areas, sadly.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's all I have to say about that. I thought it was relevant. But for other things that are more fun, I played a game. Yes, in fact, I've been playing two games, but I beat a game, mm-hmm. which is very exciting. So I put Bayonetta down for a bit. I guess I just don't quite like it as much as I wish I did. But I think I'll go back to it. It's cute, and just not like super loving it. And I don't know. We were hanging out in one of our rooms where the PS5 is, and I was like, I should play a PS5 game. And then I picked up a PS4 game because mm-hmm. it's backwards compatible. But I played The Last Guardian, which, funnily enough, turns 10 this year. So it's the 10th anniversary because it came out in 2016. I remember I bought a PS3 for this game. Probably a lot of people did, because it was announced and said it was coming to PS3, and then it never came out, and then got pushed to PS4. And, you know, then I finally bought it. And I don't know, I bet it probably was because I got soured on the whole thing, because it was like dragged on and on for so long. I was like, well, there's no way it's going to live up to my expectations now, so I'm bummed out. And I feel like around when it did finally come out, the reviews weren't like super positive. Though when I went back to kind of look and see, you know, what's online now, people seem pretty positive, aside from the controls and some of the, you know, frustration in that area. So I don't know if I just perceived it as more negative than it was, or what. But like, this, the Team Ico, I believe is their name, the people who developed this and Shadow of the Colossus and then Ico, like, yeah, those are some of my favorite games. So I was really excited for The Last Guardian. I thought it was going to be so cool. It looked super cool. And then I just never played it. And then 10 years pass, and finally I've played it. I decided to pick it off the shelf, and I was like, today's the day. I'm going to start playing it. And I got really into it like right away, and then like, why did I wait 10 years to play this? Have you ever had a game like that?
I'm sure I have, but yeah. I can't think of one right off the top of my head.
I was thinking before we started recording the podcast, like, would that ever happen to you with, say, something like a new Silent Hill game? Like, if you were really excited about a new Silent Hill game, but then everybody said it was crap, you would probably still play it anyway.
I would have played it, yes.
So, I just sort of put things off. So I guess I just wasn't vibing with it at the time. And then it just kept putting off and off, and then never got around to it. But I'll say The Last Guardian was cute. I thought Trico is really neat. I like the, you know, bond that you have with him, and you get to climb on him. So it's got a bit of the Shadow of the Colossus there. And then you also call out to it and lead it around. So it's like some of Ico in there as well. So they've married those ideas that they, you know, honed in those two games together in a fun way. I didn't have as much trouble with the controls in the sense of directing Trico. I think a lot of the commentary that I saw just after the fact looking at it seemed to be that it was annoying to control him or get him to do the things that you want him to do. But I think this goes back to, like, one of the reasons why I really like Monster Hunter. It's like, he felt like a real animal. Like, his behaviors weren't necessarily what you always want him to do, because he's a creature, right? And that may have also been because the controls were purposefully wonky, or maybe not purposefully wonky. Like, you have the R1 trigger. You push down, and then you can push one of the different face buttons, and it will have your character do and say something that's supposed to be some kind of command for Trico. And it's never really explained what those commands are, but you kind of get the idea. Like, one of them seems to be, like, move forward or go that way. And another one is kind of like, good job. And another one is, like, swipe or jump. But sometimes Trico would do things differently than I expected when I did one of those things. So that I kind of chalked up to, like, the realism of this is a monster and you don't necessarily know what it's going to do. But also, you know, even if you could input the controls perfectly, it might not listen to you because it's kind of like a cat, you know, a really big cat. But that wasn't really annoying for me. It also didn't happen too much. And I liked that, like, if you didn't really know what to do, you could kind of let Trico do its thing. And then it would sort of direct you. Like, it might look up in a certain direction. And then you look over there, too. And you're like, oh, okay, there's a, you know, a hole in the wall that we can jump up to or something. So that was neat. What wasn't neat was a couple of puzzles that you had to do as the boy that were infuriating. You remember watching me try to do this basically human hamster ball puzzle, but it wasn't actually a ball. It was like an oblong thing. I couldn't get it to roll properly. And I was like, I know where I need to go and I cannot get him over there. Mm-hmm. And it drove me mad. And I eventually did it, but I was so mad. And there was one other one. Oh, there are enemies in the game. And like Eco, they don't kill you outright. They kind of carry you off. Like they would carry the girl off and that, and then into some door, and then it's game over. So in this, the enemies will pick up your character and carry you off. And there is one puzzle where, so when you have Trico with you, it will take care of the enemies. But there was one puzzle where you're without Trico. You have to deal with an enemy, but you also have to grab an item. And I just had the hardest time evading the enemy and also grabbing the item, which then slows you down. And so I had to, like, try to kite the enemy around, but just was really suffering. So both of those times had nothing to do with Trico. So I'm just maybe bad at it. But overall, I thought it was really fun. Really pretty world, you know, interesting themes. It got a little weirdly, like, sci-fi for me. So, I don't know if I loved the ending, but I don't know what kind of ending I would have loved. It was fine. And luckily, wasn't as sad as I thought it might be. We were both like, they're going to kill Trico, aren't they? But they did not. Sorry for minor spoilers for a 10-year-old game, but it doesn't die, so that's nice. And yeah, it was a solid like 15 or so hour game. I played it, I think, basically over a long weekend, right? 3 days or so, and had fun with it, and now I can move on. So that was nice. As for other games I'm playing, I picked up Otome Daoshi. Well, by picked up, I mean literally picked up my Switch to play it. Axis was kind enough to send me a code for this because, well, as of our recording time, I will be guesting on their Thursday live stream tomorrow, May 26th, to celebrate the launch. May. March 26th, thank you. to celebrate the launch of Otome Daoshi. That's their latest Otome game from Otome. And this is a Chinese fighting, so kind of martial arts themed Otome game, which I think is a fun theme that I haven't really seen a lot in Otome games. And it's very colorful, very bright, kind of, I would say, happy-go-lucky. It doesn't have like a really like ominous atmosphere or anything like that. So if you're looking for a fun, upbeat, just good old time kind of Otome game, this seems like it will be good for that. I'm currently playing the common route and I'll continue to play it and then chat about it on the stream tomorrow. I really like the art so far. One thing I find really funny is that, like, two of the guys you meet in the common route, you meet both of them by running into them and falling on them. So it's like, usually there's only one like that, right? You get one banging into a guy, but now you've got two. One thing I really appreciate about the protagonist is she's, like, really horny. She's really into guys. So one of the guys she meets is because she overhears two women talking about a hot guy they saw. And she's like, well, I want to go check it out. So I'm going to follow them. Like, what? So I appreciate that she's kind of like, unabashedly into it. So we'll see if that keeps up throughout the game. But I'm having fun with that. So if you want to check out the live stream, I'll leave a link, I guess, to Axis's Twitch account and YouTube account in the show notes. I think they usually leave it up or have a VOD, at least partially, maybe a cut version, but you should be able to see at least something of my spot on their stream. I mean, you haven't been playing anything, but we've watched some things.
Yeah, a few things. One movie that we watched from our Vinegar Syndrome watch was actually on a two-pack of a Blu-ray, but so far I've only seen the first one. It was called Nothing Underneath. And it's about twins, a brother and a sister, who the sister is like a famous model, and she has gone overseas to do some work there in Milan. And the brother is just in America doing his thing. But because they're twins, they also have a psychic connection. So something terrible seems to be about to happen to his sister. And so he rushes off on the first flight to go there and find her, only to, you know, arrive and she just kind of seems to have disappeared. That's the premise. It's a giallo film. And I thought it was fun. Not the best giallo I've ever seen in my life, but it was fun.
I can't say I've seen many giallo, probably.
Yeah, but you've seen like top tier, like Suspiria.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, if you compare it to Suspiria, it doesn't really hold a candle. That's like
the king of the castle.
Yeah, okay. But it did have a very fun scene with an actor who's pretty famous, right?
Yeah.
The what is he, like the detective guy?
No, he is the guy.
He's a detective.
In this movie, he's a
detective. Yes, yes, that's what I mean. Yes.
Donald Pleasance.
Yes. So he's the commissioner in this film.
Yes. But he's in Halloween as well.
And he in Halloween is not a detective. I think that's why you're getting confused. He's like the psychologist or therapist in that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a really funny scene where him and the brother are in a Wendy's in Italy. And this Wendy's had a buffet? No, like a salad bar. And then we Googled that because I never knew that a Wendy's had a salad bar. So apparently that was a thing.
Yes, apparently.
Yes, I like that.
That was fun.
Yeah, and then he made some quip about how he need 10 napkins or something.
Because American food is messy.
Yeah, yeah. I like that he's like, I gotta take this American kid to the Wendy's.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a fun film. And so it comes with a spiritual sequel in the Blu-ray pack that you got from Vinegar Syndrome. So we'll probably watch that too. That one is also about models, but they're like models trapped in a house and they start dying or something like that. So that will be fun to check out. And that is a keeper, right?
Yeah, I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
We watched it on Tubi.
Yes, woo, Tubi.
Because it's always easier to just quickly pop it on.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I think, didn't we find out on the Blu-ray it has like a new audio track?
Yeah, Italian, which is funny because, you know, it's giallo film, but it's in English originally. Mm-hmm. But the Italian track on Vinegar Syndrome's release is not subtitled, so.
Yeah, so we wouldn't really be able to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Someone will.
But that's cool. I like that they did that. Mm-hmm. So we also watched a new documentary from Shudder.
Yes.
Based on a book that you have.
A book that I have, but not one that I've read
yet. Oh. Well, it's not really one that you read, right? It's more of like an encyclopedia.
I actually don't know. I haven't cracked it open.
Oh my gosh, how embarrassing. Yeah. Anyway, we're talking about 1,000 Women in Horror, which is written by an Australian critic.
Yes.
And they adapted this. Well, would you say adapted? I don't know. They made a documentary inspired by it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of chronicling women actors, female directors, people involved with making horror films about women that are horror. Just kind of all that goodness. which is what I, why my intro today was the way it was for the show.
Yep, because you didn't explain it at the beginning at all.
No, I did not. Everybody had to wait until now, or else they've tuned out and they're like, "That went, how the weird." But that's how we roll. Yeah. Anyway, oh, we could just love women in horror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. We do also. The documentary, it's split up into like phases of life.
Yes.
So it starts like with childhood, teenage years, adulthood, old age, and then I guess, or somewhere is also childbirth.
Yeah.
And it just kind of talks about different things that fit into those categories as it goes through. I think it was fun. I always love a documentary. So already I would have been happy. But then I also love documentaries about horror movies because it's my favorite thing. So it's better. And then it's about women.
Women, your other women favorite thing. Or women-focused
horror movies. So all in all, it was obviously going to be a win for me. I just enjoyed it a lot. It gave me some things to put on my list. It reminded me of some things that are on my list that I have not watched yet. So, you know, that's always good. Remind me to get into them. But overall, I just thought it was cool. I liked the folks that they had talking on, you know, about the different movies. They all seem pretty cool. I want to see some of their movies if I haven't seen them yet. So I really liked that. Just a fun time. I just wish it were more. I wish there was more. I wish it was like volume one of the documentary and then there's volume two.
They could have easily done that.
Because there's so much you could talk about.
Yeah.
I mean the book is huge. So I guess I'll look at that.
Yeah, it's quite thick. Yeah.
Probably over 1,000 pages itself.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But it's just fun. I like that.
Yeah, it was very fun. I recommend.
I mean also serious because being a woman, there's a lot of things in the world that are nasty and that are explored in horror.
Yes.
So there is kind of, you know, some heavy topics.
Yes, I would say some heavy topics and also some stuff to be aware of, like if you're squeamish, like they do show some horror film scenes that I was a little... Some gory stuff, yeah, for sure. Like they go on and show it, which is fine, but I feel like not always. Like sometimes they'll talk around it and not necessarily show everything. And then... Yeah, one part that really got me was, I think, is she an actor? I think one of the women talks about getting a cesarean section and what that was like and how horrific it really is. And that was pretty intense, like very graphically described, you know, but also good. It's like, why aren't people talking about, you know, how these things really go down? They don't.
Yeah, for sure. That one also stuck out to me. You know, for whatever reason, my whole life, I know what a C-section is in theory, but I had never actually known in detail, like, how it is actually performed.
Yeah.
So, I have that information now, and it's like, damn.
Yeah.
I mean, everything about childbirth can be crazy, but it's just like, that's very interesting. You know, a lot of people have had C-sections anyway.
Very interesting indeed.
Yeah.
And then finally, we started watching one TV show called I Love LA, because we sure love LA. It's created by Rachel Seno.
Yes.
Seno.
Yes.
And you like her.
Yeah, she's cool.
Yeah, she's very cool. And I think we were interested in this show, but not sure whether we'd like it. And I read that it has a lot of Gen Z humor. And then I also read that one of the writers is a trans man, and I thought that was cool. And then I also saw some clips kind of floating around on Instagram, and I thought they were funny. So I was like, you know what, let's try it. So I think we've watched 3-ish episodes so far and quite enjoyed it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, so far. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I like the type of humor that's in stuff involving Rachel Seno as a writer. Or actor. I really love Shiva Baby. I enjoyed Bottoms. I also enjoyed, Bodies, 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 although I'm not sure if she was involved in writing or just an actor in it. But anyway, I like it, that kind of thing. I like young characters who are privileged and shitty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that describes this well.
When the point is that you're kind of laughing at them or hating them, not when they're, like, you know, pegged as desirable or good, yeah. Which they're not.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Yeah.
I just think it's funny and also a ridiculous show.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's funny to think about, you know, as someone who lives in the proximity of LA, it's like, yeah, there's a lot of this rings true.
Yeah, or it seems like things that I feel like I've seen or heard about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's got like that sort of marketing aspect to it because Rachel's character is like a manager for an influencer, but like she's in a marketing firm as well. And so it's like, you know, influencer marketing and all this stuff that, you know, kind of someone who's worked in marketing and PR, I'm sort of, you know, familiar with it, though not in this context, obviously. But yeah, that I'm just thinking about how they had like a crisis management moment that was very funny because there's like a whole bit about the influencer getting in a beef with another influencer, and then they're posting videos like on social media just being awful to each other, and they talk about like how many days you have to wait to do a rebuttal based on what type of content it is. So if it's like homophobia, then you have to wait a day, and you know, racism, you have to wait 3 days. I don't know. Anyway, it was very stupid, a lot of stupid stuff like that, but fun. So I think we'll keep watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I haven't read anything, but you have. So you've continued well, to read.
You're reading something.
Oh, I am. I'm reading Perfect Blue, the book that the film was based on, but very slowly. I keep thinking that it's going to like creep me out before I have to go to bed because it's like, you know, creepy stalker guy. Like, almost more so than the film, I feel like.
Okay.
Well, you get the guy's point of view. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Anyway, so I'm like, I don't want to creep myself out before bed. I got to read it in the middle of the day.
Okay.
But you've been reading many things. Some things you're not going to talk about because you didn't like them, but there mm-hmm. are some you wanted to mention.
Yes. Things that I actually enjoyed because it's so rare.
Yeah.
So I've read multiple things that were recommendations from a CitrusCon panel about boys love and girls love media to read. Some of them I did not enjoy, but there was one that I did enjoy. In that presentation, they had a section on monster romance. And so one of the recommendations was called His Slender Embrace, which is about Slender Man. And so very funny premise. I decided to read that one because I'm like, this is silly. And it was silly. But it was also nice. I liked it more than pretty much most other romance books I've read in recent memory. So good job on your kind of jokey thing being better than it probably was anticipated to be.
Can you say what you thought, how you thought it was better? Like what?
It's because the characters are nicer. They're like more normal. I feel like a lot of times in romance, the characters are written really strange,
okay.
In ways that they're really annoying or really stupid. You know, these types of things that
mm-hmm.
it just makes them unrealistic. It was somehow the Slender Man story was more realistic.
That's really funny.
So I just enjoyed it, and I was like, great. And then at the end of the book, it said, like, other books in the Monster series, as well as other books by the author. And in that, I saw that this author wrote Dracula fan fiction. And the book was called A Delicious Descent. So I'm like, well, I'm down for that. And when I say Dracula fan fiction, I mean, like, literal, because, you know, Dracula is kind of in the public domain. So you can literally write about Dracula and Jonathan and these people. So I decided to read that next. And I thought that was really good, actually.
Good.
As a fan of Dracula media, including the book, it pulls a lot from the original text, so it feels like it would fit in with it. I thought that was really cool. You know, it starts off the same way, but then diverges pretty quickly when Jonathan arrives at Dracula's castle. But I just thought it was cool. It's like, okay, it's fun. It's taking the source material and putting in other things that it's like, that could almost be there. You know, like, instead of feeling torn from leaving his soon-to-be wife, he feels relief that he has to go to this faraway castle because he maybe doesn't want to marry her because actually he's not attracted to her because he likes men. Anyway, so I could see that. Already vampire media is often very, you know, gay or queer coded, so it fits there as well. But yeah, I thought it was very fun. I would recommend it if you like Dracula. It is erotic as well. I wouldn't say it's nearly as like off the charts spicy as Book Talk people say.
Did they say it was spicy?
Heated Rivalry.
Oh.
Which is like constant. But it's there. I liked it. I liked the book overall. I think that I now want to continue to read this author because they have other books as well. And I think this is just what I need to do. It's like I got to read a million books and find a couple authors I like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can actually enjoy reading because I'll read more of their things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting there. I'm slowly chipping away and there finding people I like.
And then you could even see like if they sometimes they're on Goodreads or social media and they might even recommend books too. Some mm-hmm. authors do
true,
that.
True.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we've hit a milestone. You've actually talked about a book that you can say you really
like. Well, I like Challenger as well.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm already like into this world of nonfiction stuff.
Fiction. So. We're talking about fiction. Yes. Fiction that you can enthusiastically say with your whole chest that you like.
Yes, I like A Delicious Descent.
Okay.
Although the cover is so terrible. The cover is so bad. But the book is quite good.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to hear it.
Good.
Hopefully you can read some more books you like. Unfortunately, I already know that the one you're reading right now you're not enjoying.
Yep.
But there's always the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I can say, well, there's always the next episode of Pixel Pixel when we see you again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.